with Shorty Hutchinson on September 14th, 2004. The first question I have for Shorty is the locations of the dealerships, auto dealerships in downtown LeGrand, which was pretty extensive and has a long history. Go ahead.
Ron, in 1946, the very first in January 1946, as my memory recalls, there were 9 established auto dealerships in business in LeGrand, and all 9 of them were within the confines of the downtown area, and there was, to point out sort of where they are and give you an idea of where they were, why M.J. Goss Motor Company was at 1415 Adams, the present location where they've been since 1932. Prior to that, Goss Motor Company had been down on the corner of Adams and Fur, where the Wells Fargo Bank is presently located. And they were there for 10 years, from 1922 until 1932. There was Walker Motor Company, which was the Ford, Mercury, Lincoln dealer, and he was located where Max Square is presently located. It was at the corner of 4th Street and Adams Avenue, and he was the Ford, Mercury, Lincoln dealer. Across the street from him, from Walker Motor Company, was Perkins Motor Company at the corner of 4th and Adams Avenue. They were located in the building that is presently housed by Blockbuster Video, and they were the Buick, Dodge, Plymouth dealer. Then Gettings Lynch Motor Company was located at that time down on the corner of Fur and Jefferson, and I think there's a small eatery of some kind in there, a little restaurant. They were located in there, and they had their auto dealership, their parts department, their garage was in that building, and then there was a ramp along beside the garage that went upstairs, and their body shop and car storage was upstairs in that same building.
And they had an elevator?
No, they didn't have an elevator.
How did they get the...
They drove the cars up that ramp, and when I was working for Gettings Lynch Motor Company back in the 50s, we still were taking large Buick sedans and Cadillacs up that ramp, driving them up that wooden ramp to get up into the storage area. It wasn't any longer used for a body shop. After Gettings Lynch Motor Company built their new building in 1951 and moved down to the present location of Lynch Motors at Adams and Hemlock, then they used the old location of Gettings Lynch Motor for just their body shop and storage up above for their cars. Now that's what that, they were using that facility for, storage up above until after I left the Gettings Lynch Motor Company. They were still using that up there. And if it was rainy or anything, or snow on the ground, you couldn't get a car up that ramp because there had been so many cars up that ramp that it was slick, and you just couldn't take one of those big automobiles up through there. It was too narrow. Anyway, to go on, there was Gettings Lynch Motor Company was, as I said, was located at Fur and Jefferson. Hamilton Motor Company was the Chrysler Plymouth Oldsmobile dealer at that time. He was located at 3rd and Adams, where EONI TV or internet service is, not TV, but internet service is presently located. And that was Hamilton Motor Company. It was run by a gentleman by the name of Bert Hamilton and his son, Earl Hamilton.
What cars did they sell?
They sold Chrysler, Plymouth, and Oldsmobile. There was some smaller dealerships. There was Ferguson Motor Company at 1517 Adams next to the Chevron service station across from Globe Furniture. And they were Willie's Jeep. Willie's had made a small four-cylinder sedan, and they also made a Jeep after the war, which was the small CJ model Jeeps, and also the Jeep station wagon, which was pretty popular with farm people. Herlocker Motor Company was the Hudson Motor Car dealer, and he was located behind the 76 service station, catty corner from Globe Furniture.
What did they sell again?
They sold Hudson. Hudson Motor Cars. And then there was Oregon Tractor, which was located at 3rd Street. And it wasn't 3rd Street. It was 5th Street and Depot. And I made a mistake there. I'm sorry. 5th Street and Depot. And they sold Packard Motor Cars. And then later, after Ferguson went out of business, they also took on the Jeep dealership.
I thought 5th and Depot ran the same way.
5th Street runs parallel to 4th Street and comes down and intersects Depot right across from number 10 Depot,
okay.
the eating restaurant.
Okay.
And right there where the post office is located now, the back of the post office was where Oregon Tractor was located.
Okay.
And they had Packard Motor Cars, and they later, along about 47, they acquired Jeep because Ferguson Motors went out of business. Then Paul Bunyan Motor Company was run by John Larrison Sr. and John Larrison Jr. And it was located as you come out of the underpass and circle around to the right. Paul Bunyan had a big shop back over by the California Pacific substation. And they manufactured a custom logging trailer that was patented by Larrison, but they also sold, they were the dealer for GMC trucks and Land Rover four-wheel drive vehicles.
The British car.
Yes, the British. It was an all-aluminum Land Rover at that time. Wasn't it near as expensive or near as successful a vehicle as the Rover is now. But it was the same basic automobile company.
Did it have a good reputation then? Because later they had a reputation as an indestructible vehicle.
Yeah. I don't think they didn't have near the following. I can't even recollect. My memory's pretty good on what was sold, and of course that was what I had an interest in. I can't recollect them selling any new Land Rovers.
Okay.
Mr. Larrison, young Larrison, drove one himself, and that was about the only one that I had seen around town. And I don't, but he did sell a few GMC trucks, and they were the GMC dealer. Now later on, in long about 59 to 60, Gettings Lynch Motor Company got the GMC truck line, and Larison had gone out of business. Oregon Tractor was just about out of business. Ferguson Motors had gone out of business, and Hurlocker Motors had gone out of business. And that left LeGrand with M.J. Goss Motor Company, Walker Motor Company. Walker soon sold out to Claude Hand and became Hand Ford Sales. Gettings Lynch Motor Company remained in business. Perkins Motor Company sold out to a gentleman by the name of Shaw. And Shaw ran that dealership for a short time, a couple of years, and then he went broke. And so there wasn't... It left the town with M.J. Goss, Gettings Lynch Motor Company, and Gateway Auto was formed in 1959 as a satellite dealership by one of the partners and owners in M.J. Goss Motor Company. Opened up Low Cost Auto, and after about a year, they renamed it Gateway Auto Company, and they became the American Motors Jeep dealer at the same location, what 3rd and Adams, where Hamilton Motors had been.
Okay, these were what you referred to before as the war years,
yes.
Immediately after World War II, and people had money coming home from the service. So this was a good economic time for, I'm guessing, LeGrand, but for the auto industry.
It was a very good time for the auto industry in some respects, but, you know, it takes several portions of the picture to make it a successful business. And right after the war years, you had people coming back from the service with money, and most businesses were making good money on their products, but in the case of the automobile business, for 2 or 3 years, there was a very great shortage of automobiles because automobile manufacturers were still trying to re-gear up to building automobiles instead of war machines,
mm-hmm,
and
yeah,
war supplies. And so you take, they had a problem, you know, a lot of automobile dealers that were in demand, such as Pontiac and Ford and Chevrolet and Oldsmobile, and they had waiting lists for cars because people put money down and waited on their automobiles.
How long did that period go on where there was a shortage of automobiles?
They pretty much caught up by the time that I'm going to say that they caught up by about 49 to 50. It took them a couple of years to get caught up.
What happened to the industry and the number of dealerships then? Did that change at that time?
Well, dealerships, I think they found that in order to, whenever the supply became plentiful for automobiles, the manufacturers got to making greater demands of their dealers, and they want them to stock more vehicles. And the dealers that hadn't bankrolled their profits, if they made any, weren't capable of putting, say, 5 to 10 new cars on their lot for people to come in and choose from. And I think they got to where the manufacturers were distributing their cars to the dealers in the big cities that were buying in larger denominations, and it virtually starved some of these small dealers out.
Hmm. Did you see that happening in LeGrand, where some of the dealerships you've mentioned didn't stay in business very long?
Well, it became when cars became more plentiful, automobile manufacturers put people out in the field as district managers, and they would come and call on the dealers, and they would pretty much try to see that the dealer operated in the way the company wanted them to. The manufacturer, I should say, wanted them to. And they wanted them to stock the product, merchandise it properly, display it in showrooms. And if these dealers didn't have a proper showroom and didn't have the money behind them to stock these cars, for one reason or another, they either got frozen out by the manufacturers or they just plain went out of business. And also you had to have a good relationship with your banker. You had to have flooring for those automobiles because when they pulled up out in front, or when the train pulled in back in those days, we used to get our new cars on the train, and they would run a boxcar up by the siding down here at Union Pacific, and we'd go down and unload six new cars. And those cars are always paid for before they leave the factory, either in cash or the bank. They call the bank and draft your account, and those cars are floored by the bank, and after 30 days you pay flooring on them each month. And so some dealers weren't capable of carrying on that type of business.
Okay. Right after, at the war years, this is the time when you were first in this business, there were a lot of returning soldiers.
Yes.
They were involved in that. Who else was buying? And particularly one question, were any of the black members of LeGrand involved in that? Would they buy cars?
Yes, I know of a few that bought new cars, and a very few. They were mostly used car customers, but I know of one in particular that was a good customer of Gettings Lynch Motor Company, and I know of one or two that were good customers of Goss Motor Company. They had the railroad to work for, and I know back I'd heard stories of when they were some blacks working up in the railroad in the logging communities up in Wallowa County. They would, whenever they got paid, a lot of times, why they would often order new cars back in the old days.
Were those the two areas where the black community did well economically? In, I think you've mentioned logging and the railroad.
Yeah, I think the railroad and logging, and then we had one family here that I knew of in particular that was in business for himself, and he had the local shoeshine shop, and they blocked hats. They had a shoeshine shop. They later branched into furnace cleaning and things like that. And so, but you didn't have a lot of black families in LeGrand when I first come to LeGrand. And, the community, the black community, for one reason or another, only was comprised of about, I'm going to say, 4 or 5 blocks down on Monroe Avenue at the very most.
Okay.
And I didn't, for instance, I didn't recall there being over 4 or 5 students in LeGrand High when I was a sophomore in LeGrand High School.
Okay. Was that because they were staying home, or?
No, I just, that was because of the population.
The population was that low?
Yeah.
Okay.
Population was low.
How about the Chinese community? Was that very active at that time?
Absolutely inactive. I'd heard stories of the Chinese being a very active community in LeGrand, located, they had a Chinese area, a business district located down on 4th Street and Jefferson, and it ran on down 4th Street toward, I'm not sure what that street is down there, Grandy or the street below Jefferson, but anyway, I had seen pictures of it in Richard Herman's and John Turner's put together a very nice historical book of pictures, and it came out and it was comprised of 1985 to 1985 back to 1885, and there were pictures in there of the Chinese community, but I had no knowledge of, there wasn't anything left of the Chinese community down where Commercial Tire is presently located, and that's where it had been.
Was Commercial Tires there when you came, 1946?
There was a large building there that had been a truck shop and different things, and later was Ford's Tire Service, and then was bought out by Commercial Tire. But there's always been a sort of a truck shop or tire service located in that building.
Okay.
Since I came.
Do you know if that was Chinese-owned before it became part of the larger community?
It was. That corner, I believe I showed you one picture of that corner, mm-hmm. and on down that looked like it was probably at least a block long there of Chinese buildings. And they had pool halls and billiards parlors, I guess you'd call them, grocery stores, smoke shops, and things, probably some Chinese food stores and one thing and another there. But I knew of nothing personally. I'd heard stories that they were in business at that time. Back prior to the time that I came here.
Okay. When you came here, who else was buying cars? This is in these war years immediately, but what other groups of people were in the car market? And we can probably go into trucks and farm implements too.
The interesting thing about trucks, you mentioned trucks. When I first started selling cars, I came back from the service in 1953, and I went to work for Gettings Lynch Motor Company and was hired by Mike Lynch. And I sold new and used cars, basically used cars when I started out, because they were, it was a little easier, I thought, to learn the used car business. And at that time, they were Pontiac, Buick, and Cadillac dealership, and also had International Trucks. They had previously had Nash Motor Cars and dropped that line. I was, at that time, you sold farm trucks to some of your successful farmers, new ones. Not a lot of them. You might sell three farm trucks. I'm talking about a 2.5-ton farm truck that you'd haul grain to the grain elevator out of your field. Or you might haul cattle to the stockyard to the livestock sale. But you didn't sell many trucks in a year's time. You might sell two or three. And you might sell six pickups in a whole year. And that was a big plenty. But as opposed to sales now, where you'll sell sometimes 6 to 10 or 12 new pickups, Chevrolet pickups, in a month.
When did that start changing? Because I know pickups, your rig is what it's called around here, is a big business.
Well, it is something that in this country has evolved because you live in this Grand Ronde Valley, and if you leave here or work around in this valley in the wintertime when the weather gets bad, people feel a security when they're driving a four-wheel drive vehicle. And four-wheel drives have more or less really come into their realm back in the 70s, and it just steadily increased since then. I know when I worked for Gateway Auto Company for 17 years, and we were the Jeep and international dealer, and we sold many, many, many Jeep four-wheel drive Wagoneers. We sold Toyota pickups, and people started developing a love affair, you might call it, with the sport utility vehicle. And it's been coming on stronger and stronger, and you know, it's nothing at all in the last years that I was selling where when you had a young woman walk in the showroom and want to talk to you about a pickup, or she would just as likely want to look at new pickups as she would a new car. And where we always used to sell the greater number of new vehicles, automobiles, cars, coupes, a lot of coupes, hard top coupes, and coupes, as opposed to about 50-50 on coupes and sedans. And now you rarely sell a coupe. The big turnover in new vehicles is in what they call trucks. They're pickups, they're four-wheel drive, long wheelbase, short wheelbase. Now the big thing is extended cabs with four doors. And you see as many, if not more, women driving them than you do men.
Was that true when you first came in? Because you were selling coupes and sedans, but were women the primary buyer of those, or was it generally the man?
They weren't the primary buyer. You sold to families. You sold to men and women, and you certainly didn't want to discount the woman because she carried as much weight in the family as the man. And many times the woman would pick the color, the man would choose the equipment. Sometimes they took turns picking the color. I had several customers, one in particular I can remember, where the woman and the man would always have a confrontation over the color of the car, and finally she'd say, "Well, you picked last year, this is my turn to pick this time," and she would get to pick the color of the car. But I've actually had them get in a discussion over the color to where I would say, "Folks, excuse me for a few minutes," and I'd get up and leave them alone in my office, and I'd go make a phone call or go out and maybe get a cup of coffee or something and come back in a few minutes after the smoke cleared. And usually the woman got to pick the color.
So you mentioned a couple cars, vehicles that strike me as having a similar function as the SUV, the Land Rover and the Jeep. The Jeep is sort of a quasi mini truck, at least the old Jeeps were. Was that true, and is that market really expanded?
Back in the 60s, when I left Gettings Lynch Motor Company in 1961 and went to work for Gateway Auto Company. A friend of mine had acquired Gateway Auto Company, and he happened to be Bob Goss, a brother to Bill Goss that ran Goss Motor Company at that time. And I had been friends with the representative from International Harvester Motor Trucks, and I run on to him and introduced him to my boss, Bob Goss, and we went out to dinner, and when we ended up that night, we had the International Motor Truck dealership. We already had Jeep, the little Jeep, the Jeep wagon at that time, mm-hmm. and the Jeep pickup. Now we had the International Scout and the Light Duty International line, which gave us a half ton and three quarter ton pickup, and also the farm truck line. So this gave us, we had the four wheel drive line sewed up at that time because Chevrolet hadn't come out with any kind of an SUV or any kind of a four wheel drive that was popular at that time. So we had a corner on the market. We sold to sportsmen, mill workers, farmers. We sold Scouts because they were actually more popular through those first years that International Scout come out, because they had a body with a roof over it and doors that open and closed and fit properly. Type Jeep. It didn't have a top, a roof, or anything. You just bought the Jeep with two front seats in it, and you bought a rear seat was extra, and they sold for about $2,395 that way. But then you had to buy a $600 or $700 metal cab and put on them, or you could put a $300 canvas cab. But it was, you know, it wasn't much good in the winter, and you'd freeze because those Jeep heaters would, you could hear them running, but as far as getting any heat out of them, it was pretty sparse. So International Scout really took that market for a while and just overwhelmed Jeep with it. And we sold those International Scouts to all kinds of people. I sold them to teachers and farmers and mill workers and people, and you know, we even sold International Scouts to business people that were engaged, that were working for other automobile dealers for sports vehicles that they could go hunting and fishing in their off-duty hours. So it was that people in this area really developed a love affair for the sports type vehicle, and that they could go out and go hunting, go fishing, go up in the hills and truck through the hills, take their family with them. And so pretty soon, why, you could see people were buying more and more and more four-wheel drives.
These are still people with families,
yeah.
Generally.
Oh, yeah, a lot of families. And a lot of family people interested in that, because around here, you know, why people have these mountains, and that's why they live here and put up with the snow in the winter time, is because they love this country and the scenery and the places that it affords them to get out, you know, into the hills. But later on, we could see that there was a trend toward people buying pickups, and now for the last, I'm going to say probably since the late 80s, why, you've had a lot of people that have moved into suburbans, because you've got the soccer moms and the family, the women that are taking their kids and and carpooling and taking other kids to these functions that these kids get into now, such as soccer and baseball and little league and volleyball and all these sports type activities. And these women haul these kids in these Chevrolet Suburbans, these GMC Suburban type vehicles, the Ford Explorer and the big Expedition. And when somebody gets out of a vehicle and walks into your dealership right now, if you're representing Ford, GMC, Chevrolet, or whatever, Jeep, you can figure there is a large percentage of them, they're going to want to see some kind of an SUV, sport utility vehicle. Mm-hmm.
How about the farm implement business?
The farm trade, it's a very interesting thing, and it breaks down into, it's just very simple. Farm equipment for the farmer has become so expensive that by the time a farmer buys self-propelled combines and hay balers and drills to plant his crop and other farm equipment, if you'll stop and think, if he used to take and buy a 2.5-3 ton truck and put what we called a combination bed on it, which had a what we call grain racks that went up about 4 feet on the sides for hauling grain to market, and then they had stock racks that were attached to the top of those grain racks and folded up, and he could haul horses, cows to market. He could haul these horses around if he was going to ride up in the hills for his cattle. Why, they were called combination racks. And you also put a twin telescopic hoist underneath them. And by the time you got one of these rigged, you had a lot of money wrapped up in that truck. He actually only used that truck on the farm just a couple or 3 months of the year. And then it sat around, and usually when you found those trucks, you didn't get to sell very many of them because farmers didn't put but maybe 2,000 to 4,000 miles on them in a whole year. So all of a sudden then in the last 10 to 15 years, trailers, stock trailers, gooseneck stock trailers have come into the picture, and they can put a lot of calves, cows, horses into these horse and stock trailers, and they can pull them with a heavy-duty pickup, which they drive that pickup all year round, and they back under that gooseneck trailer and drop it on the hitch mounted in the bed of that pickup and take off and go out here and load just almost as many cows or horses as they were loading on those trucks and take off down the road with them. This has been a very popular transition for farmers, but it killed the stock truck sales to farmers because farmers all of a sudden say, well, hey, why do I buy a big old truck and let it sit out here and gather dust, let it in the rain and snow or put it in the barn or whatever, but I only drive that thing 2,000 to 4,000 miles a year. Why not get me one of these fancy stock trailers? And you'll see them everywhere for sale, and you just can't hardly, you run up and down the roads in these rural areas and just look at how many of these stock trailers you see setting out in by farmers' houses and out by their sheds and their barns. And that's what the whole industry has gone from, farm trucks to these stock trailers being pulled by heavy-duty four-wheel drive pickups.
Okay, how about tractors, other kinds of implements, specialized equipment for the fields? And
they still sell that kind of stuff, Ron, but it's terribly expensive. And they're using it longer, they're running it longer, they're spending about as much money to overhaul and maintain their farm equipment, such as tractors and combines and hay balers. And as they used, they're spending as much money on that stuff to keep it going. From my observation, they're spending as much money as they used to spend to buy new stuff. But that specialized farm equipment is so expensive that you find a lot of your farmers buying used stuff, used equipment, and only your biggest farmers buying new combines, new tractors. And these tractors now, where you used to have a three-wheel tractor, two little wheels in the front and two big wheels in the back, and now they're big. They have two large wheels on each corner, and they're four-wheel drive, and some of them they're even putting tracks on them. So they've gotten into where, you know, it's nothing for them to spend $100,000, $150,000 for a piece of equipment like that, where they used to go out and be able to buy one for $10,000, $15,000.
Who sells those?
Well, your big implement companies. John Deere's still in business. They're still a big company. Massey Ferguson's a big company. And Caterpillar has gotten into it.
Okay, here in Union County.
Here in Union County.
Okay.
You have S&G Machinery out on the Island City Strip. Sells John Deere. And I don't know who represents Massey Ferguson, but you've got Caterpillar down on Adams Avenue, merchandise the Caterpillar line, and I see by some of the new equipment sitting out in front of them that they do have tractors and four-wheel drive tractors and stuff, where they used to at one time, all they were interested in was the big commercial construction outfits, road building and bridge building and things mm-hmm. like that. Anyway, there's been a tremendous transition in the automobile business to go to what we used to call commercial stuff or farm stuff, but it's sportsmen. They found that your doctors and lawyers and accountants and business people, they can go down and take the wife and buy a new sport utility vehicle, and she's happy as a lark because she knows she can go downtown, and if it lays down 6 inches of wet snow and she's shopping downtown, she can get in that and put it in four-wheel drive, push a button on the dash and back away and drive down the street and never worry about if she's going to get back home, even if her home's up on the side of the mountain. And that's where it's been. The American family, at least out in this country, has a definite love affair with the sport utility vehicle. They cost more to operate. They cost more maybe to maintain, but they've got them now to where the maintenance is not a problem. And but they, you know, you take an SUV as compared to a small V6 front-wheel drive sedan, the SUV will get, you know, 14 to 22 miles to the gallon, and a six-cylinder sedan will get 20 to 30 miles to the gallon. But they still have a love affair with that SUV.
Okay. Next time we start, I'd like to go. I'm going to have to go because I have to call Mr. Rowell. But I'd like to start with what plans do you have to sell a vehicle? How is that done? You've contrasted how they might sell in Portland compared to how you sell here. So why don't we pick up with that next time? Okay? Okay, thanks, Shorty. Hi, this is Ron Brand. I'm speaking with Shorty Hutchinson. The date is September 21st. We're at Shorty's house. And we were going to pick up with the kind of selling that they did in car dealerships here in La Grande and Union County.
Yeah, Ron, as I told you, the cities had adopted several different techniques that were designed to divide and separate the customer from his helpers in the family and anybody that might come along to sit in and help him buy a car. And they used a lot of different ways of doing that. But in La Grande, as in many small communities, if you were successful at selling and you took it to heart, you developed a good, close relationship with your customers, and you never pressured them, you never lied to them. The first boss that I worked for, Mike Lynch, always told new salesmen, you know, if I ever catch you lying or knocking another salesman's product, I'll write your check and you're all finished with Gettings Lynch Motor. He didn't believe it. He was a shrewd businessman, very good automobile dealer, but he was a respected automobile dealer, one of the most respected Pontiac dealers in the whole Northwest. Pontiac Division of General Motors had held Mike Lynch in very high esteem. And so I felt privileged to have been trained and to start the car business. I started my car selling career working for, I felt, one of the best I could have ever had. Because I learned how to treat my customers and how they should be treated after the sale. And that got to be very, very important to me, because I soon found out that your customers came back to you because they liked the way you had treated them before. They told their relatives, they told their kids, and they told their neighbors. And so this all played a big, important part in building up your clientele.
Now, this would be different than a city situation. Would you attribute this difference between being oriented toward the customer and high pressure?
Yes, you see, where in the city, their intention was to always run you past several different salespeople within the same business, because by doing that, their intention was they could wear you down. If you had a personality conflict with one salesman, he would introduce you to another salesman, and that salesman would ask you, well, how are you getting along with old Jim there? You guys about to make a deal? And you'd say, no. And he'd say, what seems to be the trouble? Well, we can't get together on a price, or he doesn't seem to have the right product he doesn't have a car with the kind of equipment on it that I want, or for whatever reason. So this fellow would start asking you questions all over again, and you would reveal things to him that maybe you didn't reveal to the first fellow. But then he would turn you over to maybe a sales manager or a closer, and their idea was, once they got your name on the order, they always, if you made them an offer on a car, they always put it on paper. They would not go to their supervisor without it being on paper, because, as they put it, until you're on paper, it's just conversation. If you sign that you'll pay X number of dollars difference between your trade-in and the car you want to buy, or you make them an offer on the car that you want to buy, then they'll take that, put it on paper, and have you sign it. Then they would take this offer on paper to their supervisor, and their supervisor would say, we can't do this, but we have qualified this man as a buyer. He's no longer a shopper or a suspect or a prospect. He is a buyer. He's signed his name.
How would you do that same paperwork in LeGrand?
Well, in LeGrand, you talked with your customer, and you know, you said, and a lot of times you've been working with him. Maybe you've been trying to find a particular used car for him, or a used pickup, or you maybe it was a new car, and you'd say you wanted this particular color with this and this and this equipment on it, and I have found one, and here's what it's got on it, and this is the sticker price. Now, one thing we haven't ever discussed is you used to just put a price on a car that you got from the factory, and you marked it up a certain percentage, and you put a price in the window of a car. Then he came out with a truth in lending law, which said that when you financed a car, you could not charge the customer for any more time on the contract than what he actually used. And it also said that the factory would put a manufacturer's suggested retail price, what we call a MSRP sticker, on the window of each new car. That sticker, by law, is to remain on that window until that car is sold ultimately to the purchaser. And that tells what the retail price is on that automobile for that particular list of equipment. And it had a lot of information, such as all the standard equipment and what the options were that were on that particular vehicle. So, in LeGrand, in answer to your question, and I felt it was important at this time to tell you about that Monroney, what they call the guy's name that was, I think the guy's name was Monroney, that came out and came out with that proposed law that passed. And that Monroney sticker has to be on that new car and has to be on them today. You don't necessarily have to sell that car for that amount of money, but anything that you do in respect to price has to be on that Monroney sticker from the factory, MSRP, manufacturer's suggested retail price. And if you do anything additional to that new car, such as you put aftermarket paint treatment on it, or you might add paint stripes, some striping, or enhance the side of it with some kind of detail, or you might put some gravel shields on it, some what we call mud flaps or gravel shields. Anything that you put on that that's done after the factory, that's done at the dealership, has to be on what we call an additional dealer sticker. For dealer installed items.
Okay, back to my question about when do you get down to actually working with signing contracts with customers here?
Okay, what you would do, you would talk with your customer, and he would say, well, Shorty, you'd ask him, you know, you would say, are you satisfied with this vehicle? And he'd say, yeah, this is what I want right here. This is what I'm going to buy. Okay, why don't we let me take and have our appraiser appraise your car, and let's find out what it's worth, your trade-in. That's the next thing we're going to have to do. So he would give me the keys to his car. I'd get the sales manager or appraiser for that dealership to come, and he'd get in his car, and I'd get in with him. We'd drive him around the block. He'd come in, and he'd get out the NADA or Kelley Blue Book, NADA was National Automobile Dealers Association, which for many years was the standard by which they dealt in all used cars, both pricing them and buying them as used cars, trading. And he would take the Blue Book, Kelley Blue Book, or the NADA book, and book out that car and all the equipment on that trade-in, arrive at a trade-in price, and he'd give you a figure on that, and you would go out and approach your customer with the trade amount difference that you would accept between his trade-in and the other vehicle. And if he said, gee, that's not as much as I had hoped to get, and you told him what you were going to have to do to recondition the trade-in, everybody, of course, thinks that their car is in top condition, but of course, why are they getting rid of it if it's in top condition? In most cases, in at least 60% of the cases, there are things, maybe it needs tires, maybe it needs some dings touched up, or it might need a little painting, or the upholstery might need cleaning, but it needs a general reconditioning, and that costs money. And so when you'd agree on a price, then you'd write up an order on it, a sales order, and you'd sign it, and the customer would sign it, and you would take it to the sales manager, and he'd put his okay on it, and you would either arrange, then at that time you would discuss financing, and we would go to the finance personnel. There's usually a person in every dealership. Some big dealerships call them the F&I manager, finance and insurance manager, and that person seeks financing for your customer. Their business is getting on the phone and phoning in or faxing in a credit application if they wish to finance. And generally, the business that I worked for at Goss Motor Company, we made it a point to shop for financing just like you'd shop for a car or anything else. We would put that information, that credit application, out to three different financing institutions. It might be GMAC, Wells Fargo, and one other bank.
How is that financing cars? How has that changed during the time you first started getting involved in sales here in the present day?
You mean as far as the interest rate or the way it's done?
The way it's done, because...
Well, as I said, they passed a law, which was Truth in Lending Law, and a lot of times, back when I first started selling cars, I have seen dealerships, none of which I worked for, but I have known and heard stories from my clientele that they would have a car financed with a dealership that they had bought a car from previously, and if they went in and paid that car off early, they didn't give them any of their unused interest off. And they passed a law back in about the, I've got to stop and think, it must have been in the early to middle 70s, and it was a Truth in Lending Law, and you had to disclose to the customer several different things, but above all, you were only allowed to charge the customer for the amount of time that he used on that contract. So if he paid that contract off within 12 months and it was a 36 or 48 month contract, then he got credit for the unused portion of that contract. That interest was refunded back off of his payoff. What you do, if somebody come in and said, Shorty, how do I go about paying off that car that I bought from you? We sold a piece of property, and I've got the money from it, and so I kind of wanted to pay that car off and stop that interest. So we would phone the financing institution, whether it be the bank or GMAC, and they would reach an immediate, what we called an immediate net payoff. And that was back figured from day one using what they called a term, was called the rule of 78s. And it is a way of computing the actual time used by days. And they figure the first 30 days, and they would take that interest off of the total amount of interest. Then also, toward the first year contract, you pay more interest than you do toward the latter part of the contract. And by the, say, on a 48-month contract, if you've paid 40 months into it, you've paid all of the interest, per se.
Okay. Now, as far as a person making a deal with a dealership, then, the actual value of his vehicle, if they're still paying on it, is, with the actual amount that has to be paid off, is less than the payments would be if they continued paying it off through the life of the loan.
That's true. And if you say, if you're a customer and you come to me and you say, Shorty, I'd like to trade cars with you, but I still owe money on this car. And I say, that's no problem. And you say, well, what do I have to do? Do I have to pay that off before I can trade? No, you don't. What we do is we arrive at a trade-in figure for your car, and we call for an immediate net payoff figure on your vehicle from the lending institution that you were doing business with. We find out how much you owe on your trade. We take that amount off of the value of your vehicle, and the difference is the net trade-in that you will have to apply to the vehicle you want to buy. So, in other words, we're dealing with a net figure as far as you're concerned. We're going to pay off your car. We're going to take the amount of money it took us. Say you owed $4,000 on your car. Say that we allowed you $6,000 for your car. We're going to pay off that $4,000. We're going to take the $4,000 from the $6,000 trade-in figure, and you have a $2,000 net equity to apply to your new car.
Okay. Do dealerships ever fiddle with this new amount? Because if they don't apply, if they take just what you think you owe on a vehicle, if you paid it off, that's a higher figure than the net payoff figure if it were paid off all at once.
Okay.
Do dealerships ever try to get around and do that?
They can't.
The laws are set up?
Yes. And they wouldn't dare. If they ever got caught at it, they'd hang them out to dry.
That'd be a very serious...
They'd fine them. That's a very serious thing. And every now and then, there is a monthly automotive newspaper that comes out to dealers they subscribe to,